Welcome, fellow plebs. My name is Sean, and this is
Tribunus Plebis.
Welcome, everybody. Today we are going to talk about a man who is something of a folk hero in the labor movements of the United States, but who often lacks a following outside of that particular circle. He's a man who unselfishly gave absolutely everything to help the poor and the working people of this country. I hope that this episode will help flesh out this incredible life for anyone who knows the name, but not much of the story. And I also hope that this episode will introduce this man to a few more people who might feel inspired by that same story and his struggle. Eugene Victor Debs was born on November 5th in 1855 in Terre Haute, Indiana, to Marguerite Betrich and Jean Daniel Debs, Alsatian immigrants and owners of a retail grocery store. The Debs family was pretty solidly middle class, and Eugene's youth was, as far as I can tell, rather unremarkable, though he was notably precocious and said by some to be a bit of a bookworm. Debs attended public schools until he was 14, at which point he dropped out and went to work for the Vandalia Railroad. His first job with the railroad was degreasing and cleaning the engines, a menial and filthy job. Eventually, young Debs would work his way into the slightly more prestigious repair sheds, where he would become a paint scraper and, eventually, a painter of railroad cars. And here he would remain for a time, scraping old paint off of and reapplying new coats of color to the company's freight and passenger cars. Then one morning, a fireman failed to show for work, and Debs was pressed into service. These first few jobs that he held, engine degreaser and cleaner, paint scraper and painter, and then fireman, these experiences would be integral to the man that Debs would later become. And I really want you to hold that in your mind as we move forward here. Now, the position of fireman on an old steam train was a filthy, hot, dangerous job. The job entails not just shoveling coal into that insatiable maw of the steam engine's fire plant, but they must also scrape, wash, and clean the fire and ash boxes as well. And Debs must have done an admirable job on that first day because he soon became the newest payrolled fireman at Vandalia Railroad, and he remained such for 3.5 years. Eventually, Debs tired of heaving shovelfuls of coal into those fire boxes and left the railroad. Debs would spend the rest of his life working for those who labored on the rails, but he himself would never again spend another day working directly for any railroad. During these 4 years after he quit, Debs worked as a clerk in the family grocery business while he attended night classes at a nearby business school. Once he was finished with his schooling in 1875, Debs joined, in solidarity with his past comrades, the newly formed Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen as a charter member, and he became active in the organization. Over the next 18 years, he worked his way up to editor of the BLF's own Fireman's Magazine and was eventually appointed Grand Secretary and Treasurer of the Union. The Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen was a relatively benign union at the time. They were loath to strike and had not ever struck in the history of the organization. In the beginning, Debs was a supporter of this stance. He believed in a paradigm where ownership and labor should work together as friends, hand in hand. As such, the BLF was essentially worked over by ownership via small handouts like free transportation to meetings and so forth to keep the leadership docile, all while wages were kept low and the conditions the workers faced were kept poor and unsafe. This belief that he held, that labor and ownership should and could work together, even seemed to compel Debs to enter politics. From 1879 to 1893, Debs served as Terre Haute town clerk before being elected as a state senator in 1894. As a state senator, Debs introduced a bill to help railroad workers. It dealt with work hours, pay, and safety issues. Debs was so confident that his bill would pass the Senate that when it inevitably failed, he was so heartbroken by the heartlessness of his fellow senators that he refused to run for another term. Debs's participation in the 1888 Burlington Railroad strike, where labor suffered a near total defeat, along with several deaths at the hands of strikebreakers and Pinkerton agents, began to more fully convince Debs of the need for a more confrontational stance for labor as they took on the immensely powerful railroads, at the time, one of the most powerful industries in this country. This was a view which would affect his later career in very fundamental ways. But before we dive into his more public and well-known career, let's take a moment to dive into his personal life just a little bit. Okay, so Eugene Debs married a woman named Kate Metzel on June 9th of 1885. And his marriage, almost everywhere that I've seen it mentioned, is always just simply mentioned. Very few people have really talked much about their marriage or about Kate in particular, but some have. And here we have some pretty divergent takes. On the one hand, we have the book The Enemy in the House, a historical novel by Irving Stone. In that book, Kate is depicted as being completely and utterly against Debs's organizing and his politics, which led to a rather cold home life and even led Kate to go around town and very theatrically spend money in as public a way as possible to show that she did not believe as her husband did. The entire Metzel family, but especially Kate, were portrayed as being obsessed with money and material things, and as being openly hostile to Debs and his beliefs. Yet there's another side to this story as well. More modern scholarship and study paint an entirely different picture of who Kate was and what she believed. Research from Michelle Killian Moran, compiled as a paper entitled Kate Debs, the Other Radical, comes away with a completely different view of the woman. In this paper, Kate is shown to be every bit the equal of Debs, intellectually and ideologically. In fact, she spent a lot of time on the road with her husband as he traveled from whistle stop to party gatherings and union meetings. It's hard for me to cipher out which of these two Kate narratives is more accurate. The money-loving shrew who despised her husband's work, or the ideological equal who happily supported that same work and held similar, if not even stronger, ideals. What I can tell you is that they had no children. Beyond that, these bits here, and this two-sided story with no clear answer, this is pretty much where Debs' personal life, especially after he becomes one of the most famous, or perhaps infamous, men in America, ends. I'd like to think that the true story of the Debs marriage falls somewhere in the middle, at least. If not more towards the modern scholarship, because, hey, nobody wants to hear and read about a bad marriage, right? But unfortunately, all I can do right now is tell you both versions of the story and let you good folks decide which seems more likely. So with that discussed and kind of set aside as an unsolved mystery, let's dive back into the public parts of this man's life and not dwell on the possibly salacious details of, you know, him and his wife's home life. So now it's 1893, and Debs has resigned from the BLF and organized the first industrial union for unskilled workers, the American Railway Union. Before this time, craft unions were the dominant form of union in this country, especially in railroads. A craft union is organized around a particular skill. So in a railroad, to use the obvious example here, the engineers, firemen, painters, mechanics, and switchmen would all have their own unions. So just think about this for a minute. To make one of these old steam engines run, it took two men, the engineer and the fireman who I mentioned before. The engineer would actually drive the train. They would manipulate the throttle and the brakes, and they were responsible for the safe operation of the engine. The firemen, as we talked about before, broke coal into pieces and fed the firebox. They both belonged to different craft unions, despite working side by side. And rail companies, They generally allowed these craft unions to exist with no real fight back because of two things. One, they were easy to deal with because the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers did not work with the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen because they were different crafts. And neither of those unions worked with the painters or the mechanics and so on. The second reason is that these unions did not strike. They operated more as fraternal orders than true labor unions as we tend to think about them in modern times. These craft unions would negotiate for their own wages and benefits, but often came into conflict with each other as they battled for their own piece of the pie. An industrial union, on the other hand, organizes all workers, regardless of their particular skill or even lack of skill, within an industry. This allows more workers to operate as a unit and negotiate for better treatment across the board. And that is the sort of union that the new American Railway Union was meant to be. Debs was elected as this new industrial union's first president upon its founding. And let me tell you something, my dear listeners. The road was rocky for this new union right from the jump. Almost immediately upon the formation of the ARU, both Debs and the union were forced to deal with wage cuts from the Great Northern Railroad Company, the GNR. GNR began cutting those wages in August of 1893, with more wage cuts coming in January and March of 1894. The workers, as one might suspect already, did not like this one bit. Facing pressures from the workers and buoyed by his newly minted radicalism, Debs led the American Railway Union, the ARU, in a strike against GNR. The workers struck and completely shut down the Great Northern for 18 full days before the company capitulated and met all of the workers' demands. This was a great victory for the new union, an astonishing victory even. And personally, I feel like this strike and this victory is greatly overlooked in the history of organized labor in this country. Part of the reason why it's overlooked is fairly obvious. The victory led, almost directly, to the much more famous Pullman strike against the Pullman Palace Car Company. That strike has drawn nearly all of the attention by historians in the years since, and it's understandable to some degree for sure. You'll see why the Pullman strike is so incandescent to historians in a few minutes. But let's discuss the GNR action first. The Great Northern Railroad strike is so often overlooked for two reasons, I think. One is that the union actually won. This is a remarkable fact, but it doesn't generate the awe and outrage of the modern reader. The other is that there was no bloodshed and no death. Again, this lack of body count does not titillate the modern media consumer. However, the importance of this strike goes beyond just those two facts. Even more importantly and significantly, the union victory over GNR convinced other rail workers to join the ARU at a rate of nearly 2,000 workers per day. It was this show of power by an industrial union rather than by the still dominant craft unions which led to the railway workers taking on a corporation and power as large as the Pullman Company just 1 month later. It was also a salve of sorts to the open and still festering wound that was cleaved into the American labor movement after the Haymarket Massacre and the executions by hanging which followed. So I really wanted to just touch on this often overlooked strike for a minute and point out how massively important and influential it was for showing how much more powerful an industrial union can be over a craft union, and for how it reinvigorated both confidence in its workers and convinced more workers to join the ARU. And also because of how it helped push away some of the Haymarket horrors, or at least, you know, well, push away was probably the wrong word here. Perhaps I should say it, maybe it helped heal a small part of that psychic and emotional trauma, I guess. In the end, it led to a massive recruitment surge, a boost in confidence, and greater radicalism and militancy. It was in the following month that Eugene Debs began to become the man who has come down to us through history. Debs rose to become a truly national figure during one of the most significant strikes in the history of organized labor in the United States. In what came to be known simply as the Pullman Strike, ARU workers refused to handle any Pullman cars or any cars that were attached to Pullman cars, effectively halting nearly all rail traffic west of Detroit. The strike was so effective at disrupting rail service because Pullman cars were far and away the most common cars on the railways. To find a train with no Pullman cars was exceedingly rare, especially around the Midwest and Northeast, the heaviest traveled routes in the country. Part of this was just the sheer number of the cars in existence and rolling around the country, but the other was the Pullman business model, where they actually operated the cars themselves, and they paid the railroads to attach the cars to their trains. The strike began after Pullman Palace Car Company unilaterally cut wages by half in many instances, while at the same time refusing to lower the cost of rent in its company town, known as Pullman, Chicago, where most of its workers lived. And I do want to take a few seconds here and let you folks know about Pullman, Chicago, the company town where the huge majority of the Pullman workers lived. Firstly, the Pullman Company literally owned the town. They owned the shops, the churches, even the homes and apartments. It owned the roads and the electrical service and even the water. The workers had no say over anything at all. The rents were higher than the surrounding area. The water and electric rates were much higher in Pullman than elsewhere in the city. And the Pullman Company refused to allow its workers to even own their own homes. Yeah, seriously. If you worked for Pullman, you lived in Pullman's own little fiefdom town, and you literally could not own a home in it. Now just imagine you are working for a company, and then you are paying that company nearly all of your wages back to rent a house, pay the electricity, and even buying your groceries from that same company, all at higher than the prevailing rates in the rest of the city. Now imagine if that company cut your pay by 50% and then refused to drop any of the other costs. Well, that's what happened to thousands of workers in Pullman, Chicago, and they didn't like it any more than you would have. So the workers struck. Now, as a wildcat strike was about to break out at the Pullman factory, Debs urged the workers to not strike, citing the newness and the weakness of the union at that point, the political strength of Pullman, and the threat of other unions not honoring the strike. And he also foresaw the state and federal government's responses. The union membership decided to push on, and Debs, serving the will of his men, led the strike. The federal government quickly sent orders to the ARU to handle any trains which carried U.S. mail, whether they contained Pullman cars or not, a move which would have effectively ended the work stoppage because of how many rail cars had postal freight loaded in them. The union refused to concede to the president's demand. In response, President Grover Cleveland sent out a new set of orders. These orders were sent to the U.S. military and U.S. marshals, and those troops and police were directed to get the trains and mail moving again. Now, I think it might be important to recognize something here. The orders President Cleveland sent out concerned the mail, but this wasn't really what his order was about. I want us all to understand that. These orders to get the mail moving were merely the cover Cleveland needed to do the bidding of Pullman and get the trains moving again. That is why the federal government really sent those troops to Chicago and other cities, not to move mail, but to bail out George Pullman and his company. And when the feds arrived, they went on the attack. Riots broke out in several cities, resulting in mostly one-sided violence. Over 70 strikers were killed, and another 57 were badly injured, and at least 4 men were arrested, including one, Eugene Victor Debs. Property damage from the strike, including union sabotage, totaled in the neighborhood of $80 million. Debs was arrested for obstructing the U.S. mail, again, cover for what Debs was really arrested for, standing up to Pullman and his company, and sentenced to 6 months in prison. While in prison, Debs was truly radicalized, and he would emerge a changed man. Many dozens of pamphlets and books were sent to Debs in his prison cell, and he would read them all. Debs became a socialist while in prison, due mostly to his readings of several prominent socialist thinkers in that cell, along with a visit and conversation with V.L. Berger, a socialist magazine editor from Wisconsin. When Debs was released from prison, he was released as a different man. He was now a politically activated socialist as well as an effective, longtime labor organizer. It was at this point in Debs' life that he truly and irrevocably became the man that most of us remember or have learned about. Debs would soon take the remnants of the ARU, which had folded when he went to prison, and start the Socialist Democratic Party of the United States. He ran for president of the United States in every election from 1904 to 1920 under the socialist banner. His highest vote totals were in 1912, when Debs received 6% of the total vote, and in 1920, when he garnered 913,693 votes, the highest total ever for any member of a socialist party in this country. He received 0 electoral votes in any of his campaigns. Debs himself, despite taking leading roles in many organizations and despite running for the presidency of the entire country, tended to downplay any role of leadership that people laid upon him. He typically encouraged those who felt like he did to lead themselves and join with others who were fighting for similar goals. In 1906 in Chicago, Debs said these words, quote, "I am not a labor leader. I do not want you to follow me or anyone else. If you are looking for a Moses to lead you out of this capitalist wilderness, you will stay right where you are. I would not lead you into the promised land even if I could, because if I led you in, someone else would lead you out. You must use your heads as well as your hands and get yourself out of your present condition." End quote. It was during this time, between his release from prison after the Pullman strike and before World War I, that Debs made much of his most direct impact both within the labor movement and across the political classes. On June 27th of 1905, Debs, along with many other famed labor and socialist leaders like Big Bill Haywood, Eugene DeLeon, James Connolly, and yes, Mother Jones, who you can hear about in episode 12 of this very podcast, by the way, they gathered to create the Industrial Workers of the World in Chicago, Illinois. It was a real who's who of radical labor and social change, and the Wobblies, the nickname that all IWW members are known by, became an immediate radical force in the American labor struggle. The IWW was an industrial union, much like the ARU was, with a stated goal of uniting all workers, or at least a whole lot of workers, and implementing a general strike to get their demands met. I don't want to get too deep into the IWW because it's a vast subject and good fodder for another episode, maybe. And, you know, this one's about Debs, not the IWW. But by the late teens, its power had begun to wane, and by the late 1930s, the IWW was, in all manner of speaking, nearly dead. However, I will speak about this era a little bit more broadly. The turn of the century, from the 19th to the 20th, was also a turning point for American labor. Even some of the Gilded Age giants, the masters of industry, the so-called builders of America, even they began to, at least rhetorically, speak on the matters of labor and class friction. The biggest such name was Andrew Carnegie, mega millionaire and industrial titan. But others spoke words just as hollow as he did. By 1900, unions had around 2 million workers, an astronomical figure considering where they stood just half a decade before. But despite these gains, unions and, even beyond that, truly radical and militant unions, unions which would strike and fight, were few and far between and generally only found in specific industries like mining and the railroads. Most of these unions were members of the AFL, the American Federation of Labor, and the AFL was decidedly not radical. Their titular leader, Samuel Gompers, believed in electoralism, while IWW founders like Connolly and Big Bill Haywood preferred a more directly antagonistic and militant approach. Debs himself, by this point in his career, was an absolutely transcendent public speaker. His speeches regularly lasted 2 and sometimes even 3 hours, and his physical flourishes and intense and heartfelt mannerisms incited his listeners to deep devotion. This quote is from a man described as a hard-bitten socialist, was recorded by Haywood Brown, and it says it all. Quote, Gene Debs is the one who can get away with the sentimental flummery that's been tied onto socialism in this country. Pretty nearly always, it gives me a swift pain to go around to meetings and have people call me comrade. That's a lot of bunk. But the funny part is that when Deb says comrade, it's all right. He means it. That old man with the burning eyes actually believes that there can be such a thing as the brotherhood of man. And that's not the funniest part of it. As long as he's around, I believe it myself. End quote. There then raged a war within the American labor movement. A war with the radical socialist and IWW force on one side, and the electorally minded forces led by the AFL on the other side. The AFL controlled roughly 80% of the unionized American workforce, and the radicals only a small handful, but the war raged nonetheless. Soon, there held a vote. A vote contested by enrollment rather than by ballot. An astonishing number of workers joined the IWW. Over 2 million signed on over the years, yet official rolls rarely listed more than 60,000 members in any single month, pointing to an enormous amount of turnover. And as World War I approached, the internecine labor war was fought, and the AFL won in an absolute landslide. Debs was already a powerful speaker, and his newfound socialism lent a religious revival aspect to his already charismatic and powerful oration. That religious revival aspect led to Debs becoming intensely popular. In the end, it was this charisma and speaking skill that would lead to his second stint in prison. And I feel like I should add that between the founding of the Wobblies in World War I, Debs began to pull back from his public duties and his health began to decline. Not sharply, he wasn't on death's door, but he had indeed begun to fade a bit as the teens sped onward. This is where Debs began his runs for president, in fact, when the IWW split between Big Bill Haywood's faction and the Socialist Party faction that Debs was loyal to started. Interestingly enough, Debs and Haywood remained friendly even after the split that devastated the union that they both helped found. As an avowed anti-World War I activist, though not an absolute pacifist, I might add, after all, how could he be such as a revolutionary? Debs was put in a terrible position by the passing of the Sedition Act in 1918, which made it illegal to make speech that was, quote, disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the United States government, its flag, or its armed forces, or that caused others to view the American government or its institutions with contempt, end quote. It also made it illegal to encourage anyone to resist the draft or even speak against the recruitment and enlistment service itself. And while, like I said, Debs wasn't a pacifist who was flatly against any and all potential wars, what he was firmly and statically against was imperial war, of which he felt World War I qualified. War that he felt was driven by capitalist greed. This belief is the seed from which his adamant opposition to the Great War grew. Quote, they tell us that we live in a great free republic, that our institutions are democratic, that we are a free and self-governing people. That is too much, even for a joke. Wars throughout history have been waged for conquest and plunder, and that is war in a nutshell. The master class has always declared the wars. The subject class has always fought the battles. End quote. May 16th, 1918. This is the date that the Sedition Act goes into effect. The Sedition Act is not technically its own law, but rather an amendment to the previously enacted Espionage Act of 1917, which was passed shortly after the United States officially entered the Great War, which would come to be known as World War I. The Sedition Act expanded the Espionage Act to include actions which were even more troubling, broad, and all-encompassing than previously covered. They included, as I briefly mentioned a moment ago, speech, expression of opinion, which, you know, cast a bad light on the federal government of the United States or upon its war efforts in Europe or at home, including the draft. In short, it violated the First Amendment rights of United States citizens and provided sentences of usually between 5 and 20 years duration. And for the record, dear listeners, this is what an attack on free speech actually looks like. Keep this in mind. So now it's June 16th of 1918, 1 month to the day after the passing of the Sedition Act. Eugene V. Debs, though ill and having stepped away from his more public roles of the past, has decided to step back out to deliver a speech to a Socialist Party gathering of about 200 people in Canton, Ohio. Despite the oppressive heat and humidity of that day, Debs steps atop the low platform of the park gazebo in a three-piece suit and delivers one of the most memorable speeches in the history of this country. 5 months later, Debs would be sent to prison for 10 years, simply for speaking to other human beings. A quote from that speech, quote, "I realize that, in speaking to you this afternoon, there are certain limitations placed upon the right of free speech. I must be exceedingly careful, prudent, as to what I say, and even more careful and prudent as to how I say it. I may not be able to say all I think, but I am not going to say anything that I do not think. I would rather 1,000 times to be a free soul in jail than to be a sycophant and coward in the streets." End quote. Debs, as he composed the words that would comprise what would come to be known simply as the Canton Speech, was aware of the Espionage Act and its sedition amendments. He knew he could be sent to prison for urging men to resist the draft or speaking directly against the government's war efforts. He was, by all accounts, extremely careful with how he worded his speech in an effort to thwart such legal attacks. As the crowd waited to hear Debs speak that day, agents of the Justice Department dispersed into the crowd, along with reporters and even a stenographer. The agents had been deployed to check the men in the crowd for draft cards, take down the names of those in attendance, and generally harass those who attended the event. Reporters had been sent by both local and national papers, but also under the direction of the Justice Department, to write scandalous stories of the meeting meant to push the governmental narrative of treason. The stenographer was deployed to record Debs' speech with a focus to listen for and write down any statements which may violate the freshly minted Sedition Act. The speech which Debs delivered has become one of the most famous and powerful ever delivered in the United States. Debs was considered a truly great speechwriter and orator, even amongst contemporaneous sources, and he did not let the attendees down. As far as I can tell, Debs mentioned the war only a single time. And if we are being maybe a little more broad and less generous, perhaps 5 or 6 mentions exist. Now I just want to quote a couple of passages here. Quote, "They have always taught you that it is your patriotic duty to go to war and slaughter yourselves at their command. You have never had a voice in the war. The working class who make the sacrifices, who shed the blood, have never yet had a voice in declaring war." End quote. Perhaps Debs, who, as we already mentioned, understood the dangers of this speech, thought that by avoiding a direct assault on the war and or President Woodrow Wilson, that he would avoid jail. He very possibly may have held that hope, but he was also fully aware of how precarious his situation was, and he made it clear as he spoke. Quote, "Rose Pastor Stokes, and when I mention her name, I take off my hat. Here we have another heroic and inspiring comrade. She had her millions of dollars at command. Did her wealth restrain her an instant? On the contrary, her supreme devotion to the cause outweighed all considerations of a financial or social nature. She went out boldly to plead the cause of the working class, and they rewarded her high courage with a 10-year sentence to the penitentiary. Think of it, 10 years. What atrocious crime had she committed? What frightful things had she said? Let me answer candidly. She said nothing more than I have said here this afternoon. I want to admit without reservation that if Rose Pastor Stokes is guilty of crime, so am I. If she is guilty for the brave part she has taken in this testing time of human souls, I would not be cowardly enough to plead my own innocence. And if she ought to be sent to the penitentiary for 10 years, so ought I, without a doubt. End quote. Debs recognized the risk. He even predicted, in a certain manner, the length of his own prison sentence and his willingness to serve such a sentence. This here is what suppression of free speech looks like. This is what a violation of the First Amendment looks like. It looks like dissidents being imprisoned for speaking words. It looks like Charles Schenck being sentenced to 6 months in federal prison for printing and mailing anti-war and anti-draft leaflets to his mailing list. It looks like the Postmaster General being imbued with the ability to deny mail service to magazines, newspapers, and private citizens who may publish material that he, and he alone, finds questionable. Think on that for a moment. The Postmaster General, the head of the United States Postal Service, was the sole deciding voice on what political messages could and could not be mailed, and who could and could not mail them. That this is deeply troubling and deeply unconstitutional should go without saying. And this all happened around World War I, and all because of the Espionage Act and Sedition Acts. Quote, "These are the gentry who are today wrapped up in the American flag, who shout their claim from the housetops that they are the only patriots, and who have their magnifying glasses in hand, scanning the country for evidence of disloyalty, eager to apply the brand of treason to the men who dare to even whisper their opposition to Junker rule in the United States. No wonder Sam Johnson declared that patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel. He must have had this Wall Street gentry in mind, or at least their prototypes, for in every age it has been the tyrant, the oppressor, and the exploiter who has wrapped himself in the cloak of patriotism, or religion, or both, to deceive and overawe the people." End quote. Suppression of speech looks like Justice Department agents recording speeches as evidence. It looks like orators being indicted over words. Suppression of speech looks like the Sedition Act itself. One other thing that free speech suppression looks like is the media towing the line laid out by the president and his political and corporate cronies. As mentioned earlier, reporters were encouraged to attend this meeting to record Debs' speech so it could be used as evidence. Among these earnest reporters was avowed patriotic avenger Clyde Miller, reporter for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Miller would go on to actually testify against Debs during his trial and help convince the jury of his guilt. However, Clyde Miller's contribution to this story, if this is where it ended, would be all too typical to draw even this much attention. But this is not where his story ends. Miller, whose reporting career had been spent essentially doing the government's bidding by seeking and exposing supposed traitors, and by extolling blind patriotism and loyalty to the country, even at the expense of our guaranteed rights, and was more than partially responsible for Debs' conviction, had a change of heart. Miller would later come to directly lobby President Warren Harding to release Debs from prison, and he would go on to help found the Institute for Propaganda Analysis, the IPA, an organization dedicated to understanding propaganda and how otherwise ordinary people can be so easily mesmerized by it. The IPA would do work on all forms of propaganda, fascist, patriotic, communist, and religious amongst them. They would even go on to analyze the burgeoning second Red Scare of the late 1940s, while it was still in its nascent stages before the IPA was disbanded. This latter work would, ironically enough, land Clyde Miller himself to be attacked in Congress by the House Committee on Un-American Activities, which was little more than another successful governmental attack on the First Amendment. And Debs, to get back to the subject more directly here, and I apologize for that brief sidetrack, was indicted by a judge in Cleveland, Ohio, and arrested 2 weeks later as he traveled through that city on his way to another event. He was indicted on 10 counts of violations of the Sedition Act and charged with hindering the enlistment service. Marguerite Prevey, a wealthy Ohio radical, paid Debs' bail, and he traveled to his home in Terre Haute, Indiana, to await his trial, which took place on September 10th of 1918. Debs wrote the following in a letter to a friend before that trial. Quote, "I am expecting nothing but conviction under a law flagrantly unconstitutional and which was framed especially for the suppression of free speech." End quote. The trial itself was, to be kind, swift. Copies of the speech, transcribed by stenographer, were presented and several photos showing Debs speaking in Canton were admitted into evidence. During the trial, Debs' lawyer called no witnesses to testify on his behalf. Instead, Debs himself was called to speak directly to the court and the jury on his own behalf. He used this time, with his conviction a certainty, to give a powerful speech in support of both his socialist cause and to defend his own and every other American's right to freedom of speech. Regarding freedom of speech, this paragraph from his statement to the court stands out amongst many others. Quote, "There is not a single falsehood in that speech. If there is a single statement in it that will not bear the light of truth, I will retract it. I will make all of the reparation in my power. But if what I said is true, and I believe it is, then whatever fate or fortune may have in store for me, I shall preserve and violate the integrity of my soul and stand by it to the end." End quote. This is what freedom of speech looks like. It looks like the right to speak plain truths and remain unmolested by the government of the United States. It also looks like an old man standing within a gazebo in a public park on a sweltering hot June day in Canton, Ohio, urging others to stand up for what they believe in and resisting tyranny in all of its forms. Quote, "Do not worry over the charge of treason to your masters, but be concerned about the treason that involves yourself. Be true to yourself, and you cannot be a traitor to any good cause on earth." End quote. In the aftermath of the trial, Eugene V. Debs was found guilty of violating the Espionage Act and sentenced to 10 years in prison. It was during this trial that Debs would deliver his singularly most famous and powerful speech, where he stated the following, quote, "Your Honor, years ago, I recognized my kinship with all living beings, and I made up my mind that I was not one bit better than the meanest on earth. I said then, and I say now, that while there is a lower class, I am in it. And while there is a criminal element, I am of it. And while there is a soul in prison, I am not free." End quote. In fact, right now, as I record this podcast episode, I am wearing my Debs t-shirt. It shows the famous picture of him leaning out of that Ohio gazebo, his face an intense mask, arm upraised as he delivers his speech. And below that photo are printed the last two sentences of that quote. "While there is a lower class, I am in it. And while there is a criminal element, I am of it. While there is a soul in prison, I am not free." Now, even in prison, with his health deteriorating, Debs carried on his work. He refused some handful of offers he received to make his time easier, preferring to shun his status as a relatively well-known political prisoner and remain what he viewed himself as and what he really was. He was a prisoner confined to a cell, just like all of his brothers in their own cells throughout that prison. Debs even ran for president from prison, and that was the year that he garnered nearly 1 million votes, his highest vote total and most ever for a Socialist Party member to this day. While locked up, Debs also took it upon himself to take the complaints of the other prisoners and argue for their proper resolutions with the guards and warden. Through this selfless act, Debs earned the respect of his fellow prisoners and even the guards and the warden himself. Howard Zinn, another great man of history, shared this anecdote about Debs' time in prison, specifically when he was released. Quote, "On the day of his release, the warden ignored prison regulations and opened every cell block to allow more than 2,000 inmates to gather in front of the main jail building to say goodbye to Eugene Debs. As he started down the walkway from the prison, a roar went up and he turned, tears streaming down his face, and he stretched out his arms to the other prisoners." End quote. The time Debs spent in the penitentiary harmed his already frail health. And though he was released by Harding after roughly 3 years, his health would never recover. He survived 5 years post-prison and died in a sanatorium on October 20th, 1926. He was 70 years old. Eugene Debs, by his own definition, was never truly free. Now, during his life, Debs was not the only person on the front lines of labor and political movements of the early 20th century. Not every advance can be traced back directly to his work. In fact, his heyday ended before the American working class and the public at large truly comprehended the importance that labor unions could and would make in their lives. In addition to all of that, Debs was an avowed anti-racist. He believed that all people, regardless of the color of their skin, should unify and fight against what he viewed as their oppressors, and his movement was welcoming of all ethnicities. However, he seemed to not understand that there existed a true difference in the societal treatment of blacks, especially in the workplace. He was fully willing to accept blacks into the movement on absolutely equal terms, as he said, which meant that they would receive no special assistance. So there exists here a bit of a contradiction, I think, that Debs either failed to come to terms with or, decided to simply stand on his belief that all were equal, both in his own mind and in reality. This miss, as I see it, it just goes to show that even the best amongst us have blind spots or ideological purity that allows us to slide past complicated issues with a bit of, hand-waving and pretty words. Honestly, I hope I misunderstand his words here, or have not read, his more clarifying writings. But in the end, Debs was on the bleeding edge of the creation of a true, broad labor movement in this country. He did not start it. He was not the only one active in his time. But he did leave an absolutely indelible mark on the organization of the working class in this country. It was through this work that labor found its voice to speak truth to power. And more importantly, they found their feet to be able to take and hold ground against a materially greater force in the form of corporations and political malfeasance. Whether in prison, walking strike lines, or giving a speech that he knew rubbed against the new sedition laws, Debs never wavered. He stood strong for the working class and the poor. Even beyond that, he actively fought for them. He fought for them each and every time, even when he knew that fighting for them would mean his own suffering. More importantly, he never stopped, not until his death. Despite any objections one may have for Debs' political convictions or method of labor organizing, no man can ever take away his honest, unending, and heartfelt battle for the laborers of this country and the poor. Very few people in our long history have laid so much on the line or suffered so profoundly for the poor and oppressed of the United States of America. And that's it for the episode, guys. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you learned a little bit more about Eugene Debs, or maybe you just learned everything you will ever know about him. I don't know, but I hope you enjoyed the episode. I really had a good time making it. If you like content like this, please subscribe, like, and if you really like it, take a few seconds to rate and review through the link in the description. It's the single best way that you can help out a podcast. Thank you guys. Love you all.